Welcome to Behavior Analysis in Practice, the podcast. Behavior Analysis in Practice is a podcast committed to narrowing the research practice gap and demystifying the research process. Each episode will take a deep dive into the latest work published in Behavior Analysis in Practice, the journal, by interviewing the paper's author about the topic. We'll explore the nuances of each paper and ask the questions you wish you could ask the authors after reading the paper. Hello and welcome back to Behavior Analysis in Practice, the podcast. I'm your host, Cody Morris, Assistant Professor of Behavior Analysis at Salve Regina University. And today I'm going to be speaking with Casey Clay about his paper, Advancing Methods in Animal-Assisted Intervention, Demonstration of Starting Points in Clinical Practice for Children with Autism Spectrum Disorder. Casey is currently the Director of Behavior Clinics at the Children's Hospital of Orange County in California. He is the former president of the Four Corners Association for Behavior Analysis, an ad hoc reviewer for several behavior analytic journals, and an author on the forthcoming seventh edition of Behavior Analysis and Learning, which is a textbook. My conversation with Casey was really interesting, talking about an area that I haven't really read much about within behavior analysis, so I found that exciting, and I think you will too. So without further ado, here is my interview with Casey Clay. Hello, Casey, and welcome to Behavior Analysis in Practice, the podcast. We're excited to have you here today.
Hi, Cody. My pleasure. I really appreciate the invitation.
Yeah, we're excited to talk about your paper, which, at least for me anyway, felt pretty unique. It's focused on animal-assisted intervention, which I really hadn't seen in behavior analytic journals. And so I think it's a lot to talk about within that. I'm excited to get into it. Before we jump into the paper, we always like to hear a little bit about the guest, to hear about sort of what brought you to behavior analysis or what your path was to behavior analysis and what your current position is, and maybe even why you were interested in this research to begin with, if all that fits together.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, I'm Casey Clay, and I got into ABA, probably in my undergraduate work at a psychology student at Utah State University. I was taking actually rat labs and pigeon labs at Utah State, and somebody came from a local preschool that was on campus that served children with autism. Somebody came into my class and it was wondering if anyone wanted to work in the preschool that had this sort of behavioral psychology background. And I thought, you know, an on-campus job would be awesome. So I started working with preschool age kids with autism in my undergraduate work. And from there, fell in love with the science of behavior analysis, went on to get my master's and PhD, also in ABA. And yeah, I think that the rest was sort of history. Currently, I am the director of behavior clinics at Children's Hospital of Orange County, here in Orange, California. And I'm primarily working more with severe and challenging behavior here through the clinics in the hospital. And so engaging in a lot of research and trying to stay as productive as possible.
Nice. I feel you on the trying to stay as productive as possible. I think that's a feeling that many of us probably experience. Now, maybe without giving away the plot of this paper too much, can you talk about how you sort of found yourself doing research that was looking at animal-assisted intervention?
Yeah, so previously to my current position, I was a professor at the University of Missouri, and one of my job responsibilities there was also serving as a director, clinical director at the Thompson Autism Center in Missouri. And the center became interested in potentially acquiring a therapy dog, and you know, was toying with the idea and asking around if folks would be interested. And they eventually brought the therapy dog to the center. And you know, this is a clinical center for assessment and intervention for kids with autism. And, you know, they brought the therapy dog in, and everyone was really excited. I was really excited. I love dogs. And so it was an exciting time for everyone. However, you know, I was a bit skeptical in terms of, you know, how the therapy animal would be interacting with the patients and clients of the kiddos with autism that I was working with and that my students were working with. And so, you know, I wasn't really sure of what the dog's role would be. Rhett was his name, so we'll talk about it as Rhett. Yeah, what would Rhett's role be at the center, you know, in terms of a therapeutic environment and in shaping and improving behavior in the center? So I, you know, decided, as I hope every, you know, good researcher or scientist would, to get pretty empirical about it and collect some data. And that's what kind of drove me into this line of research. And it was fun. You know, it was interesting at the time. I got to have a therapy dog around during research sessions. And so that was also fun. Also was trained as a therapy dog handler. And so that it was a fun experience and exciting to kind of jump into to that line of research, and students loved it as well.
Yeah, I'm sure. I really appreciate that explanation. And to me, that's one of the best parts of the Journal of Behavior Analysis and Practice, is it's somewhat emphasizing this, the type of research that's getting into like actual practice experiences, where you as a clinical director had a situation where it looks like you're going to have animals involved with the clinic to some capacity, and then as a behavior analyst ultimately going to, okay, well, if we're going to do this, we need to kind of evaluate this, conceptualize this, as we'll talk about in your paper, and collect data on it, right? And so I think that that's a great model for the folks out there who are doing clinical work, that this isn't something that like you had some overarching plan and you wrote 1500 grants to get, and it's this huge thing that took 4 years to plan and execute. This is like something that was essentially, sounds like, happening at your clinic, and you figured out a way to systematically evaluate it, and then it ends up being a great resource for people.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think on that point, in terms of practitioners, I kind of failed to mention, before I jumped into this, I looked into the literature base on it. And I think it, you know, I'd recommend, you know, practitioners kind of take a jump in, see what's out there. And, you know, when I did that and did a little bit of a literature review, first of all, there's several literature reviews that have been conducted on animal assisted interventions, and, you know, even reviews done by behavior analysts. So I jumped a little bit into that literature, and, you know, found that the evidence base, there wasn't really a systematic way folks were going about looking at the impact of therapy animals, you know, and how that fit into a methodological framework. You know, for example, you know, does the animal serve as a reinforcer? What's really happening in these animal assisted intervention sessions? And how researchers were describing those sessions. You know, it just, as a behavior analyst, I thought that we could explain a little bit better and be more systematic about this, and definitely use single subject design to investigate the impact and the effects of therapy animals. So yeah, I'd say at the get-go, definitely jump in a little bit into the literature base. And I was kind of surprised, you know, when I did that. And so I thought, hey, this might be a good opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think animal assisted intervention is probably one of those topics where behavior analysts might be a little hesitant or worried about the implications of being involved with something like animal assisted intervention. And I thought your paper really did a nice job of fleshing out really, A, what does animal assisted intervention even really refer to, or and then sort of dealing with the issues related to that because of maybe it not necessarily having a consistent description and getting into the issues and ultimately your approach. And so again, I thought it was a really cool model of a behavior analyst taking something that could be a difficulty or an opportunity that other clinicians are likely to experience and actually evaluating it in a systematic way. So we've been talking about animal assisted intervention for a few minutes now. Can we try to provide a, I know there's some complications with like defining it necessarily, but can we talk about like the way that you sort of defined it or looked at it within the paper?
I think a key to animal assisted interventions and where a lot of researchers and other practitioners get stuck is, what's the role of the animal in the intervention? Is the animal a therapy animal and it's just kind of there for comfort, or is the animal there as a kind of competing stimulus, competing with some maladaptive behavior, or is the animal a reinforcer? And so, in trying to define what animal assisted intervention is, I think a key part of that is identifying what the role the animal plays in the intervention or the therapy. And I think that's something that once we can define that, and researchers looking at animal assisted interventions define that, then we can start to answer some more complex questions of what is, animal assisted intervention, as opposed to just having a therapy animal present, or support animals like you see people taking on planes and in every other environment. Let's really define what animal assisted intervention is if we're going to be recommending it for those we work with and assessing the beneficial qualities. So it's kind of hard to define exactly what it is, and that's what I found out when I dove into the literature base. Because researchers were defining it different ways. And so, yeah, I think, there's, and the AAI umbrella is really large. Encapsulates animal assisted therapies and other types of, including animals in day-to-day lives. So definitely, different from service animal work. And so I think that's one of the ways we can create some differentiation, what it's not, and then we can begin to define it in our interventions.
Yeah, that's helpful. That's a helpful framework to use when thinking about this. I w when you begin talking about animal assisted intervention in the paper and sort of begin fleshing out really what it is or what it isn't, and we'll go back to your sort of conceptualizations around what the actual potential mechanism of action is for the animal or what the animal is serving as in the intervention, which I find really interesting. But one of the things I was blown away early in the paper is that you provide a statistic that 1 in 4 kids with ASD participate in animal assisted intervention at some point, which, considering the prevalence of individuals with autism and behavior analytic practice, I thought, wow, I mean, I would imagine, and certainly in my own experience providing clinical work, I've come into contact with many of my clients also receiving some animal assisted intervention to some capacity. But I have to imagine this is a very common experience for behavior analysts is to see their clients engaging in this type of therapy.
Yeah, definitely. It's something that I think parents, once they hear about it, they become excited. And, you know, parents are always looking for, you know, better ways to provide their children with services. And, you know, most parents also, you know, kind of might want that family pet or some animal to be incorporated in their child's life. And it's also kind of seen as sort of a normative thing, you know, or a normal thing for folks or families to have an animal. So maybe, you know, if their child can engage with that animal, that'd be good for them, and you know, kind of follow the typical development type tracks that parents are seeing. You know, I think kind of what you're saying in terms of the mechanism of change is the critical piece to this, and you know, how I wanted to arrange this study and understanding, okay, so if one in four children comes in contact with this, what's happening? You know, how are they coming in contact with this? You know, does the family go out and buy the therapy animal? Does the ABA provider have the animal that might travel with them to in-home appointments? How is this happening? And I think that stat was actually pulled from a paper by a guy and colleagues in behavior analysis and practice when they surveyed a lot of behavior analysts or you know the field in terms of if their clients engage or have engaged with therapy animals. And so, yeah, I think it's like parents are interested and it's happening. So what's really happening in terms of the session, and what's the mechanism of change if good things are happening, if we are seeing positive outcomes by incorporating therapy animals?
In your paper, you talk about the role of animals in ASC, and again, kind of getting at that mechanism of change or what the animal is functioning as. You referred to it for a moment a few minutes ago in the conversation where you said, you know, maybe a reinforcer, maybe a competing stimulus, or potentially other roles that you sort of talk about. Can you describe what those potential roles are and really how you're conceptualizing the potential role of the animal here?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the animal and animal assisted therapy and researchers doing research involving therapy animals have used therapy animals for things like to decrease physiological stress, promote relaxation. And you know, there's also, you know, how much is the response over of the client to the therapy animal? We can measure it, is I think kind of the key for us as behavior analysts. You know, so therapy animals have been included in a range of studies looking at various you know, constructs that have been developed. But I think, you know, as behavior analysts, we are primarily focused on kind of those overt changes, and you know, even possibly the covert stuff that's happening, that's promoting a lot of the overt changes, whether that's social behavior, increasing social skills, or potentially even you know, just building rapport between a client and a therapist, because the therapist brings a highly preferred animal in, and now that client associates a, you know, preferred stimulus with that therapist. So, you know, the role there can vary. But, you know, as you mentioned, I was sort of taking a role or looking at the role of therapy animal as, you know, in terms of what's maintaining the appropriate behavior we're shaping. And is it serving as a reinforcer? And I had done some previous research on, you know, preference assessment and preference assessment methodology, as well as, you know, reinforcer assessments following those preference assessments. So I really wanted to plug the therapy animal into some of those assessments that are very, very common to behavior analysts, and say, okay, is it preferred? Is the therapy animal a preferred stimulus? And, you know, will the therapy animal serve as a reinforcer?
Yeah, and I love that breakdown of those potential roles. And ultimately, you know, in my experience, seeing clients receive animal assisted intervention, a lot of the practitioners of that type of intervention can often purport mechanisms or explanations of what's happening that I think, to say the least, wouldn't be consistent with the behavior analytic viewpoint. But that doesn't mean that there isn't an actual mechanism of action or change that we can identify and actually see align with the way that we view the world and the way that we view intervention, right? And part of that being the use of an animal as a reinforcer and a potentially extremely socially valid reinforcer, because I know, you know, most of the people I'm friends with have animals of some sort that is clearly really reinforcing to interact with and engage with when they get home and all the stuff. And so to have our clients potentially utilizing reinforcers like that, well, that seems pretty naturalistic to me and pretty socially valid from my perspective anyway. So I think it's an interesting viewpoint of going, okay, well, there's a lot of different claims and stuff like that, but if we just look at what's happening in the context of the client interacting with this animal, what is happening there? How can we conceptualize that? And is that something that may be informative to our own practice? And that's where you came in with this paper of ultimately looking to see if we can incorporate the animals involved with animal assisted intervention into sort of standard behavior analytic assessments to see, hey, are these animals in this case actually reinforcers? And if so, what are the implications of that particular information for treatment moving forward? And so you did a study. It involved 6 boys. Can you talk about a little bit about the participants as a group and the setting you were doing this in?
Yeah, definitely. So these were younger kiddos, ages, I think, 4 through 9. They're all diagnosed with ASD, and the setting is early intervention or early intensive behavioral intervention clinic there at the Autism Center in Missouri, as I mentioned. And you know, these participants were receiving EIBI services, so they were familiar with, you know, the one-on-one therapist format, and they were, you know, getting the typical types of interventions you would see in early intervention, speech focused on, you know, receptive and expressive vocabulary, also things just like basic instruction following tasks, and so yeah, just probably what a lot of folks in the field are familiar with when you kind of mentioned the early intervention center. And you know, what was interesting to me is sort of the diversity of these participants there in Missouri and kind of the different experiences they had with dogs. However, you know, all the parents said they liked dogs. They reported that their kids liked dogs, and I think that that's a really critical piece to this. Is, you know, sometimes we look at this information from parents on the likes and dislikes of their kiddos, and we want to make sure that kind of checks out, and that we are really using, you know, preferred and effective stimuli in what we're doing in the clinic. So yeah, so the participants, I guess, like you said, there were 6 of them, and then I should also mention our therapy dog, Rhett. He was a black Labrador Retriever, and he was trained as a therapy dog, and we had trained handlers also on site, and he was, you know, a center dog, and you know, he. I guess there's some considerations to go into the related to therapy animals. I'm not sure if now's a good time to talk about that.
Sure. You know, and related to some of those considerations, just because it's such a different world than I'm used to interacting with. I'm curious, with a trained therapy dog, or like acquiring a trained therapy dog in this situation, is that a situation where you, as a center, acquire the dog from
essentially an organization that says like, hey, we essentially breed or train therapy dogs? Or is this something where you get the dog and then you send them to the training? Like, how does that work?
The former situation you described, and that is, there are organizations that train therapy dogs, and then the center, or our center, particularly reached out to that organization, got to choose, I guess, the dog that would come stay with us at the center and live with a handler in the specific city in that location. Which, you bring up an interesting point is. That type of situation, I think, varies for a lot of individuals, well, for a lot of behavior analysts and for a lot of centers providing services, because the situations can vary. It could be that, they do get an animal, or someone says, hey, I have a therapy animal, can I bring them in? Or those type of situations, which is actually, I put in a, kind of a note of caution there. There's not really systematic regulations for how we're bringing in these therapy animals and they're interacting with children with autism. So, in our particular situation at the center, they reached out to the organization that trained the therapy animals, and they had a long history of training therapy dogs. So they're really reputable in the area. And we got to actually see how they trained the dogs, which was interesting as a behavior analyst, and kind of the different methods they were using for training the therapy animals, learning, different commands, or, cues that we could provide the therapy dog with. So yeah, I think the situations vary, and I think you really have to be careful about where you're getting a therapy dog from, and then when you bring an animal, I mean, any animal, into a clinic environment with children, there's always the potential for something to go wrong there. So you have to be really sure that the therapy animal is well trained, and that you've taken all the precautions you possibly can there.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It sounds like you spent time thinking about the sort of the safety of the dog in terms of its training and all of that. Was there consideration for like the participants who would be exposed to the dog in the sense that like, maybe, I'm thinking about my own experience. I had a client who engaged in problem behavior specifically toward his dog at his home. So he'd try to like hit or kick his dog, amongst other things. And, I imagine there he kind of actually probably gets into some interesting ethical areas of we probably wouldn't be appropriate to expose a dog or any animal to potential abuse from the clients of the program as well. So what's your consideration of that? How do you sort of mitigate issues related to something like that?
Yes, absolutely. You're looking out for the animal's welfare and well-being, as much as the participants there, it kind of in the situation. And we made sure, we also served clients that had challenging behavior, and we made sure that they I guess part of the inclusion criteria was that these participants didn't engage in that challenging behavior. Just because we didn't want the risk of exposing the therapy animal to some type of aggression or even property destruction. And so yeah, we definitely took that into consideration. And then also just throughout the sessions, and to get this study approved through IRB, we were monitoring the therapy animals sort of signs of stress, heavy panting, licking paws. Those types of behaviors, if that was happening frequently, then we would have ended the session. Fortunately, this therapy dog had a lot of experience with the kiddos, and so he was really comfortable around them, and loved to get pet, and loved when they brought out kind of little toys for the therapy dog to play with or see. And so I think that you definitely have to take that into consideration, the welfare of the animal. And it's kind of one reason why I think if behavior analysts are getting into this or are seeing this, you know, in terms of it's our ethical obligation to really, you know, make sure that the welfare of the animal and the clients are being looked after there. Yeah, so it kind of adds a level of complexity to this research project that isn't, you know, it kind of seems like, oh, this is fun, therapy animals, you know, but actually, you know, we definitely took the risks and precautions very seriously.
Yeah, I find I'm also the chair of an IRB here. And so I try to think about research from multiple lens, not just sort of my lens as a behavior analyst. And there are some interesting sort of ethical considerations with something like this, as we've discussed. I find that fascinating. I think it's great that you guys navigated those so that you could ultimately do this research. And so to segue us back into the methods of this paper, so you have six clients at an autism center. You have Rhett the dog involved, and he's been trained and ready to be involved with therapeutic services. What were your procedures and how did you go about arranging them?
Yeah, so, you know, we first started with a preference assessment, and, you know, to inform the preference assessment, we did kind of an indirect questionnaire that the parents filled out, and we were identifying kind of other forms of social interaction that might potentially be preferred that we could then pit the dog against to see, you know, if the dog did serve as, or what was preferred, I guess, in that preference assessment. And so, you know, we were specifically, you know, seeing, you know, relative to other types of social interactions that the participants commonly received during their interventions, such as praise, you know, high five, thumbs up, you know, playing, a lot of fun reinforcers that are rewarding interactions. Did the dog, you know, sort of hold up to those, you know, was it actually, or interacting with the dog, that is, interacting with the dog, was it as preferred as some of those other stimuli? So yeah, we put, you know, pitted the dog against those other stimuli in a paired stimulus arrangement, where, you know, we specifically had two of the social interactions available at a time, and we counterbalanced the order in which those presented, also rotated the sides on which they were presented, and allowed the participants to choose, you know, a similar, in a paired preference assessment manner.
And how were the, I'm sorry to interrupt. How were the stimuli presented? How was like the dog simultaneously available with another stimulus? Like, what did that look like?
Yeah, great question. So we were in kind of, you know, a square room, smaller square room, and the room was divided by tape. And on one side of the tape, towards the end of the room, there would be a therapist who, you know, would be assigned to deliver a specific social interaction. On the other side of the tape would be the therapy dog, you know, with the handler standing there. And then we would, you know, sort of expose the participants to each of those options, and then bring them back to kind of a center point in the room and say, pick one. And then wherever they walk to, they experience that social interaction, and we recorded that as a selection.
Awesome. And then how did you set up the reinforcement assessment or reinforcer assessment that you did following the preference assessment?
Yeah, so that was a little more complex because different participants sort of had different reinforcer assessment procedures. We used both single and concurrent operant reinforcer assessments there. We identified some tasks. Some of the tasks were, you know, fairly arbitrary in the sense that the participants had mastered the task. You know, things like sorting colors, or you know, cleaning up toys. So yeah, the reinforcement assessment, we identified the tasks, and then depending on the specific participant, we either did a single operant reinforcer assessment or a concurrent operant arrangement. And actually, in particular, I do want to point out one of the participants' response during the reinforcer assessment was just percentage of time allocated to a particular area. So the response was, you know, if they walked within a certain box that was sort of taped off on the floor, and versus outside of that box or into a different box.
And how did you choose which modifications to the reinforcer assessment to use with the various clients?
Yeah, that's a great question. So for that participant that I mentioned, the response was actually just time allocation in a particular area. That participant didn't really have a repertoire of, you know, sitting at a chair and being able to engage in a task for extended amounts of time. So that's why we chose that task. For other participants, I think there was kind of an issue with them discriminating between different conditions. So, you know, having the concurrent operant arrangement there available where they could engage in towards multiple different options for multiple consequences. We found that to be more challenging. So we did a single operant for them. So basically just one evaluating one consequence at a time to determine whether or not that would be reinforcing. So yeah, it just kind of depended on the participant's repertoire there, previous repertoire, and kind of what they were bringing to the session.
That makes sense. And I know as nice as it would be to have one universal reinforcer assessment or preference assessment that we could use with all clients, it's just unfortunately not the reality, right? People have idiosyncratic needs and require adaptations to assessments. And so I like that the study included that because it's ultimately about making sure we're adequately assessing whatever is needed to help identify the individual client needs. So after you completed those procedures with the individual clients, you, of course, were able to evaluate the results. So what did you see or what did you learn across doing those particular assessments?
Yeah, so in terms of preference, we found, you know, of the six participants, two of them interacting with the therapy dog was the highest preferred stimulus there. For another two, it was more moderately preferred, fell kind of in the middle of the items we assessed. And then for another two of the six, it was the least preferred. And one participant didn't select the therapy dog at all. So yeah, in terms of the preference assessment, it was sort of split evenly across the six participants and across different preference, across preference hierarchies. So then, you know, going into the reinforcer assessment, we found, you know, general correspondence there. So for the participants, that, the dog was the highest preferred interaction, the dog served as a reinforcer, and a stronger reinforcer than, you know, other consequences. For the next two participants, again, we saw a similar correlation there. The dog who was moderately preferred fell somewhere in between the control and the highest preference stimulus. And then for the final two who didn't prefer the dog and never selected the dog, guess what? No surprise, the dog didn't maintain any responding there in the reinforcer assessment, or low to zero levels of responding, I'll say.
So preference assessment, reinforcer assessment, both correspond, and you're seeing a split across the participants in terms of the reinforcing value of the dog according to the participant. What do you think are like the big takeaways from those results, or what do you think that really means, or how do you interpret that?
Yeah, you know, I think I interpret it, although, you know, this isn't a large study where we can kind of have, you know, conclusions at a population level, I'd say essentially not all kids with autism like therapy animals. You know, it's not safe to assume that. So, you know, one way to examine that or kind of upfront prepare for that is to conduct a preference assessment. See, you know, if someone brings up the idea of incorporating a therapy animal, well, let's test to see if this animal is preferred. Because it may be the case that they're not preferred. And you know, interesting enough, I think for the one of the kiddos that didn't prefer the animal, you know, parents said that he did like dogs and they had a dog at the house. So it's kind of interesting to see kind of the differences across different individuals there. And the takeaway being, yeah, we should be assessing for preference. And then of course, if we're integrating those stimuli into programming, they better be reinforcing. So let's determine if they're reinforcing before we start using them.
Do you see any dangers in the assumption that, the clients are going to enjoy their interactions with the animals and just operating on that assumption rather than going through the due diligence of conducting the preference assessments or reinforcer assessments?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, the cost of a therapy animal is fairly expensive. And so, you know, it would be unfortunate to sink in those costs up front and find out that the kiddos that you're bringing a therapy animal around don't prefer the therapy animal. There's also just cost in terms of wasted time, you know, and interventions and potentially presenting a therapy animal or trying to integrate a therapy animal and having it not be effective as, you know, a reinforcer or in some other sense of increasing the responding you're looking for. So, yeah, I think it is important to kind of determine the preference there, upfront, to support that we're making evidence-based decisions really, you know, and following best practice as behavior analysts.
For clinicians that have an opportunity to potentially, be involved with animal-assisted intervention to some capacity, in the context of these results, what are the big takeaways for their potential clinical practice? Like, what are the things that practicing behavior analysts should really sort of keep in mind, other than potentially, the importance of the preference assessment and the reinforcer assessment if this is an opportunity.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said in terms of ethical implications of bringing a therapy animal around your clients. Like I said previously, there's always that risk that the animal, especially a dog, you know, bites or injures a client. And that's actually a very common childhood injury. So, you know, we really as behavior analysts need to be thinking before we bring a therapy animal into environment and expose clients to that therapy animal. So there's the ethics around that. And then also, you know, ethical considerations of, you know, where did this therapy animal come from? What was its training like? How well regulated is that? How will this animal be spending their day and their time throughout the day? I think one important thing for behavior analysts to realize that I, you know, sort of didn't realize until interacting with therapy animals, they have a pretty short work schedule. They shouldn't be working for long periods of time, you know. So I think whereas as behavior analysts, you know, we try to cram as much as we can into a day, especially, you know, opportunities for therapy and with how, you know, strict billing requirements are and those types of things, the therapy animal can't be present, you know, across the course of a whole day. And in fact, you know, should have a lot of downtime to relax and to, you know, go back to their crate or a safe space and just kind of be alone.
Yeah, I'm sure there are so many sort of nuanced considerations. I would have had no idea that that is one of the sort of stipulations is their work day, which makes a lot of sense, that it is something that's gonna probably not be the same as humans and to know those variables before getting involved. We were talking about before we started recording that you haven't had quite the opportunity to do other follow-up studies on this topic. But for people interested in this topic who might want to learn more, are there either, you know, future study ideas that you could offer or resources, or is there anything for those who want to sort of sink their teeth a little bit deeper into this? Any recommendations for them?
Oh yeah, definitely. I think, you know, this is, there are several different lines of research that can branch off of this study or that involve animal assisted intervention because, like I said, sort of the lack of systematic inquiry within animal assisted intervention. So, you know, I would say if you want to kind of stick to the preference assessment line involving therapy animals, you could do video based or picture based preference assessment involving the therapy animals, and you know, see if those serve to identify the preferred animals, and maybe correspondence of the live animal preference assessment to those video based or picture based preference assessment, which sort of follows the preference assessment research canon there in terms of other any stimulus that we're assessing. So yeah, I think there's some preference assessment. I think there's also, you know, we did a study before this one that was published with a graduate student I was supervising, and we were looking at contingent versus non-contingent access to the therapy animal. You know, is it the case that you do have to sort of deliver the therapy animal, the therapy animal has to be available contingently for behavior to increase, or just kind of can the therapy animal hang out and non-contingent access, and we'll see increases in a particular target behavior. And I think there's sort of mixed findings on that. So that area would be interesting to look at as well, continuing versus non-continuing access, especially in considering the animal assisted intervention canon, where the animals are generally available non-contingently. You know, the handler will bring them in, and all of a sudden there's a lot of responding or some increased improvement. And so I think kind of identifying different arrangements in which the animal is available would be helpful in terms of investigation of previous researchers or future researchers.
Related to the research that's sort of already been conducted on animal assisted intervention, and you said sort of the common use of the animals non-contingently, I imagine that behavior analysts probably, if they are involved with or aware of animal assisted therapy being conducted with their clients, that it might be vulnerable to, again, maybe more of a pseudoscience-y sort of approach to involving animals in therapy. I mean, I certainly know with the clients I knew that were participating in animal-assisted intervention that some of the things that the clinicians were saying were not even to the point of being, you know, like just mentalistic or something that a behavior analyst might roll their eyes at. They were promising things that, you know, like curing autism sort of promises, which are quite concerning. And so that's not at all what you're presenting here, right? You're presenting like, let's look at it from a behavior analytic lens and use it in a way that aligns with our practices. But I can imagine, depending on who behavior analysts collaborate with, they might experience a push towards some of that sort of pseudoscience stuff. So how do we as individual clinicians like navigate that particular sticky area of all of this?
Yeah, that's a great question. And as you know, I started conducting this research at University of Missouri, there were those researchers that were interested in kind of doing some of that same work, knowing that we had a therapy animal at the center and maybe some researchers that had some experience with therapy animals previously. And, you know, I think, you know, interacting with them, I think it was part of the impetus for this project was to say, okay, You know, here's what previous research within the field generally says. And like you said, you know, some mentalistic explanations and kind of poorly defined operational definitions of the behavior of what we're measuring. So, you know, let's try to agree, one, you know, agree upon what it is we're measuring here. You know, see specifically in what context that we're seeing these behaviors. I think a lot of the research is also indirect. So it's a lot of surveys and asking families, whereas this is a direct analysis of the effects of therapy animals. So I think, you know, talking to, if you're collaborating, being able to kind of describe indirect versus direct effects and, you know, why we want to directly measure preference. Because, you know, if the kids don't like the animal, we're wasting the kids' time. And I think a lot of other researchers get on board with that, definitely, and can understand and appreciate that. I think, you know, if folks find themselves in this situation, you know, starting maybe with small steps too, definitely not having the therapy animal involved across the day or in every situation as a potential cure for autism, which we know wouldn't be the case, but start in small steps. Okay, maybe we can bring the therapy animal in during this particular social skills time, and we'll see if that, you know, if it's preferred, if it's a reinforcer, and then if it changes the social skills there in that environment. So start in small steps and kind of take the data, show the data. I think data can also speak volumes.
Classic behavior analytic approach, right? Measure it, define what we're talking about, conceptualize it, see its impacts by analysis, right? Like, I think it's one of these areas where, you know, there are a few things that I think are pretty common for, like, individuals with autism. The thing when reading this paper that came to mind for me was, I had several clients who were being taken to what was referred to as a sensory room, which had all sorts of amazing, interesting, fun stimuli that the clients preferred. They were taken there contingently on problem behavior as a sign of, oh, they're going to engage in problem behavior. They need to go to the sensory room to experience, you know, whatever the folks were saying was involved with the sensory room. And, you know, I'm not qualified to evaluate any of that stuff, any of the sensory processing. It's not my discipline. It's not my focus. So I won't comment on that. But I can say that I am able to evaluate the reinforcing quality of that sensory room, which was through the roof. I mean, it was, this is a really nice sensory room. And, you know, what I was able to ultimately advocate for that team to that team was, again, I can't speak to any of the other therapeutic effects of the sensory room, but I have confirmed it's a reinforcer. And I do know that if we deliver reinforcer contingent on problem behavior, we're probably going to get more problem behavior. So if we can just flip that arrangement, right, if we can do it before they engage in problem behavior, do it contingent on appropriate behavior, something like asking for access to it, whatever it might be, and have had success in that. But that reading this paper sort of reminded me of that, right? Like, what is the function of this tool that may or may not be initiated by a behavior analyst? And then how can we as a profession then, you know, be part of that treatment team and help inform those decisions? Because I find a lot of people find some of this stuff to be, you know, sticky, and they go, oh, animal assisted intervention, I won't speak about it. I won't be part of this at all. Sensory room, I won't be part of this at all. And obviously we need to stay in our scope of competence and in practice. But if we conceptualize it and we help evaluate it, as you've described here, we can be part of those treatment team decisions. We can be an active team member, right? We're not the only ones involved with it, but we can help inform how these things are used. And if a dog happens to be a reinforcer, well, that's super valuable information for the team to know so that they're utilizing the involvement of the dog appropriately.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is spot on, Cody. And I think, as behavioralists, we can look at, I think, there's been some studies, comparing SI to other behavioral interventions, and how it comes down to the arrangement. I think essentially the arrangement of, how those stimuli are provided. Like you said, can we just switch that around, not provide that contingent on problem behavior, or not a contingent, but following the problem behavior. And so there's probably lessons to be learned from some of that SI literature in terms of, well, the comparisons of behavioral interventions to the SI literature, and then sort of let's insert this novel stimulus of a therapy animal in place of kind of the SI toys or swing or whatever it might be. And we can still, going about it that way, be team players, like you said, which is critical. But even, help folks to either see or even learn ourselves. Maybe actually this non-contingent arrangement of the sensory item or the therapy animal, whatever it is, does change behavior, and we'll see that in the data. And so that's great. Let's look at that and see what we can arrange to create the best situation for our clients, and make sure we are shaping behavior in a positive direction there. So yeah, I think you're spot on with that, drawing that comparison. And it's something that I try to do is, working in autism centers, I think a lot of behavior analysts might be more exposed to interdisciplinary settings and working with SLPs or OTs or what have you there that might have different opinions of therapy animals. So yeah, it's absolutely critical to be a team player there and look at kind of the arrangements and make some slight suggestions, yeah, potentially even learn ourselves what's happening or how the stimulus is impacting behavior.
Well, I appreciate you sort of delving into this, I think, nuanced, somewhat complicated area and sort of giving behavior analyst a working model of how to begin to approach something like this. As you said, I mean, tons more research is really necessary to fully flesh something like this out. But this is a really great, important undertaking, something that we should be aware of and thinking of in the field. And so I appreciate the time and energy you put into doing this paper and to coming on the show today.
Thanks. I appreciate you having me. And I will also mention, like you said, it's an important topic. And I think the social validity is higher than we think around this topic. And actually, I just remembered, it kind of came to me. This article, when it was published, sort of went viral in news outlets across the country. So it was picked up in news outlets, although they were reporting the findings a little differently than I would suggest. But for the most part, a lot of folks found it interesting, and some of the metrics that got brought up, actually Tom Critchfield brought up to me, that I didn't realize that this article has some of the highest and alt metric sort of dissemination stats for an article in Behavior Analysis and Practice or ABA in general, which was shocking me. I was unaware of that. But like you said, it's an important topic, and the social validity is there. And so I'd encourage, behavior analysts to engage in things that are relevant to, their worlds and that other people are talking about. And if they're that align also with their own interests, to try and get more of our behavior science into what commonly accepted practices that people are excited about.
Yeah, I love that. And I think to your point, I think you've done a really nice job here of outlining the approach to that instead of running away and going, well, this person said animal-assisted intervention cures autism and that doesn't align with research and that's sort of a dangerous statement to make for several reasons. Okay, yeah, some people do purport that things that that don't align with research or that are counter to research evidence, sure. But if something like this is so popular and so sought after, are there ways of evaluating it from a behavior analytic perspective and incorporating in a way that's consistent with behavior analysis? And I think you've done a really nice job of outlining that and making that argument. So I think this is a really useful tool for practitioners. And as you said, I mean, it's something that's going to connect with the public, and that's a good thing for our field as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, I appreciate that. And yeah, hopefully we can, you know, dispel some of the myths and try and get as much of evidence-based and effective practice into services for our clients as possible.
Absolutely. Well, thank you again for coming on the show today. It's been a pleasure.
I appreciate it. Thanks again for having me.
Thank you for listening. Please remember to subscribe and like us on whatever podcast player you use, and to find us and follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest episodes. I'd like to thank a few people for helping create this podcast. Thank you to Stephanie Peterson, the editor of the journal Behavior Analysis and Practice. Thank you to ABAI for sponsoring this podcast. Thank you to my assistant producers who helped me create this episode, Jesse Perrin and Evan Switzer. And thank you to Jim Carr and his band, New Latitude, for letting us sample their song, Cruising Altitude, throughout this podcast.